The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to this week's Tech Weekly, your podcast destination for all things technological. I'm Alex Kratosky, and joining me in the Guardian pod is the lovely Jemima Kish. Charles has joined Bobby in techno rehab this week, I'm afraid. I hope it's nothing I said. Welcome, Jemima. Have you been playing with anything shining this week?
Well, not unless dogs count as shiny things.
Nintendogs?
No, afraid not. Just running with dogs on beaches.
Also joining us is Guardian Unlimited blogs editor and wrangler Kevin Anderson, who'll be making heads and tails of the US presidential election after a week, nay, a month of political highs and lows. Welcome, Kevin.
Great to be here, Alex. Can't keep my finger off the political blogs this month. Ugh, so much going on.
So much going on. And in fact, indeed, in your own life?
Yes, I'm getting married on Saturday, so this is just a brief pause between matrimonial preparations to bring us all up to speed on technology and politics.
Is this officially the romance podcast as well? Because this is romance week, isn't
it?
Oh,
I was hoping somebody wouldn't say that.
Sorry.
Anyway, on this week's show, we're going to delve deeply into the political mire as we discuss Google's sinister role in the goings-on in Washington, D.C. in 2008. Jemima's interviewed the search giant's head of elections and advocacy, Peter Greenberger. The absent Charles has sent in his review of the Asus RM notebook, also known as the EPC, a kind of one laptop per child for the developed world, but without the charitable intentions. We send property search startup Nestoria into the lift to hear their elevator pitch. Plus, as always, we tackle the news, your comments from the blogs, and more. Stay tuned for a rollicking show. Google have proven to be an extraordinarily adaptable machine. From search to social software, the company is excellent at identifying a money-making trend when it sees it, and in many cases, buying it up. And what better to capitalize on than the billion-dollar U.S. presidential election? The candidates are expected to spend $65 million over the next 10 months, and Google thinks it's got a scheme that will land it a share. Jemima, you spoke with Peter Greenberger, the head of elections and advocacy, to find out what Google's been doing for the campaign trail. From predicting outcomes using Google Trends, which is fascinating, actually, to sophisticated political online ad targeting. It all sounds a bit Big Brother to me. Tell us more.
Okay, so I think the point is here that it's not really about making money, because this is still a relatively tiny sector compared to the rest of Google's business. But it's an extremely, extremely significant move, because they're getting in with the movers and shakers in on Capitol Hill, and the people that are going to be in there next as well. So this is an opportunity for Google to show off the very clever algorithm. So I asked him, is this about Google having to educate these campaigners?
Absolutely. In some ways, campaigns are ahead of the curve, but in other ways, campaigns can be quite cautious and are sometimes hesitant to try new tools and platforms. And our job is to teach them that consumers have changed. People consume media in very different ways, and they spend as much time online in the States as they do watching TV.
Could you outline what a typical campaign might involve for one of these presidential candidates? You know, what kind of package you might put together for them?
Most of the major candidates are using AdWords, so Google search. When somebody searches on Google.com, perhaps an issue that they're interested in, many of the candidates will have their ad appear alongside the natural search results. So that's really the basic package, the core of the package. In addition to that, many of the campaigns are advertising on our content network. The content network are all the sites that are partners with Google. You'll see the Ads by Google logo right underneath where the ad is served. And that's an opportunity for candidates to spread their message beyond just search and to reach voters when they're reading information or when they're surfing the internet. So, for instance, if there's an article in the New York Times about healthcare, a candidate who's interested in that topic can have their ad appear alongside that article, either everywhere on the NewYorkTimes.com, or we can geo-target it to just certain states, which is critical during a primary campaign where different states vote at different times.
Okay, well, that was going to be my next question, is how closely can you target people and particular demographics? Because I just searched Hillary Clinton, but obviously I'm in the UK, so I just got an ad for The Guardian, actually. But can you tell me more about targeting?
Well done. You have a very savvy marketer. You can geo-target as finely as zip code, so almost to within a mile or so radius of where the user is. So if you want to reach a voter, for instance, in New Hampshire, what you can do is run ads, and those ads will only appear to users whose servers are in the state of New Hampshire. And so in that way, you're not wasting your media spend on people in Vermont or Massachusetts who can't vote in the New Hampshire primary, but instead you're focusing all of your advertising just to people who can vote. We can refine that even more if you just want to reach women in the state of New Hampshire. What we can do is run your ad on some of our sites that appeal to women, for instance, a MarthaStewart.com, and again, geo-target it. So now only viewers of MarthaStewart.com in the state of New Hampshire are seeing that ad. If you're buying television and trying to reach voters of New Hampshire, you have to buy Boston TV because a good percentage of the New Hampshire electorate watches Boston TV. However, 75% of the people watching Boston TV are in Massachusetts. So 75% of every dollar is essentially being wasted. That is not the case on the internet. We can target much more finely.
Do you share any data with candidates? You know, how much information can you give to them so that, I don't know, they might be able to map that data with the census locally or something so they know whose door to go around to and knock on?
We won't be able to dig into that detail for them. What we can do is, by seeing the results, everything that we do is very trackable. So they'll be able to know from where they serve the ads, where they're getting the most clicks, where they're getting the most impressions, and even where they're getting the most conversions. So if more people are clicking on the ad in a certain area or at a certain time or when it appears on a certain site, then they can refine the campaign and start serving the ad more frequently on those more successful sites.
In terms of sort of consulting, and obviously you know your own product very well, but how closely do you talk to candidates about their wider strategy and perhaps how they would tackle trying to engage people more through social networking?
I think, you know, as with any advertiser, the most important thing for us to do at the beginning of a campaign is to understand the goals. So in some cases, a campaign is just interested in capturing email addresses, or maybe they're just interested in raising money, or perhaps they just want to expand the number of impressions they're getting to make sure they get their name out there in front of the right people at the right time. So very much depending on what the goal is, we'll come back to them with a package of products to help them reach that audience. And then in real time, because everything is measurable and trackable, we can get a sense of, is it really working? Or maybe you thought women were your targeted audience, but in fact, young men seem to be much more affected by your message, and maybe you want to change your language, or maybe you want to target different sites so you can reach this new demographic.
It's very interesting as well. Somebody made the point that perhaps because this is really more of an internet election than we've ever had, people are being attracted that perhaps might not have voted before, or they're maybe more floating voters, and maybe that will make the outcome of the election less predictable.
Perhaps, and certainly, you know, we were all fooled here for the New Hampshire primary. One thing that I recommend to you and to your readers and listeners, a tool that we have called Google Trends. And with Google Trends, you can type in different search queries. So let's say for the Democratic side, John Edwards, Hillary Clinton, and Barack Obama. And what you can do is get a sense of which term is being searched more frequently on Google. And it's a very fun parlor trick to try to make predictions and projections on who will finish first, second, or third in each primary. What is very interesting about it, you can segment it down to region. So obviously to the United States, and then it tells you how many searches are occurring per state. And what was fascinating about New Hampshire and Iowa was that those three search terms, the places that those searches were occurring the most were, in fact, in New Hampshire and in Iowa and in South Carolina. So proving that as the media increased, as attention increased in those states, and as voters were forced to actually finally make a decision, they were searching those candidates' names, going online and looking for more information.
But how accurate were those trends lists? Did they really reflect what people thought was going to happen or what actually happened?
It's funny. I would say, similar to the polls that were taken, that they're merely snapshots, literally what people are thinking at that moment in time. I did notice that in Iowa, Barack Obama, for instance, was leading in search. In New Hampshire, it was very close. It was too close to call. It is not foolproof, but as with a poll, it does provide you with a snapshot of what people are thinking.
It's fascinating.
I've heard anecdotally that you can get a good sense of who's going to win American Idol. By trends, and I know you have, what's the equivalent there?
Pop Idol.
Pop Idol, that's right. If you want to win your office pool, just keep checking Google Trends.
That was Peter Greenberger from Google, and I absolutely love that idea of sort of predicting who's going to do what by looking. I think we were
Pop
talking
Idol
about,
fan, are you, Alex?
Not at all. No, I thought it was interesting. We were talking before about this idea of, you know, who is the top hit on Yahoo, not Yahoo, on YouTube, Kevin. We were saying that initially sort of Barack Obama was really high on YouTube. It was either Barack Obama or Britney Spears.
Yeah, I mean, it's been interesting to watch YouTube. Not only did you have the YouTube debate where people submitted questions to YouTube this year, but you also had people posting entire speeches by Barack Obama. So if they weren't at the event or they weren't watching cable television to get a few clips, they could actually watch the entire thing. And you were seeing, you know, hundreds of thousands of views of an hour-long political speech on YouTube when before it just would have kind of come and gone. And then you also had the music video made by Will.i.am of the Black Eyed Peas, which
is top of the viral video chart this week.
Absolutely. And I mean, that's another way that candidates have really gotten buzz and attracted non-traditional voters.
So, Jemima, thinking back about the Google approach, does this sort of benefit the candidates or does it benefit Google more?
Well, like I said, I don't really think it's a big kind of money-making move for Google. This is about influence and power and getting a really significant customer base. Actually, Greenberger said later on that he predicted this year total political advertising spend is only going to be about $65 million. So translating that into the proportion which is online, which is only 2.4%, and in English, that's only £787,000 for the year, which is tiny. You know, Google is not going after that. They want influence. And when you look at whether this is a kind of efficiency for the candidates or not, it's about them being more efficient with their campaign spend. And there are kind of two sides to this. There's what they're doing with Google, which is fascinating, but there's also what they're doing inside the campaigns, mapping data from search results on their own campaign websites with census data so that they can prioritise canvassing. It's almost skipping out blogs and social networking, kind of saying, we've done that, we want to be a bit more scientific now.
Now, Kevin, just very, very briefly, who would you say the candidates are looking towards?
Well, Barack Obama's definitely gotten sort of the biggest buzz as far as both of his website. He actually has his own social network that drives a lot of this. And I think one of the key things is Barack Obama has actually used his massive presence online to do a huge amount of fundraising. He has 300,000 individual donors who have given him money, which is one of the reasons why he's outraising Hillary Clinton 2-3-1 in this election. So it has been a huge advantage for Barack Obama.
Well, thank you both very, very much. You can follow the twists and the turns of the US election trail at guardian.co.uk/America. And now let's find out what else is happening in the world of technology. Jemima?
The UK government plans to introduce a cinema-style rating system for video games designed to protect young children against violent or sexual content. Retailers who sell to underage kids face heavy fines under the plans, which anticipate the results of next month's Byron Review of Violence and Gaming. Is DAB on its way to becoming the Betamax of the web? Despite healthy sales of digital radios, 4 DAB stations have closed in the past month, with GCAP Chief Executive Fru Haslett saying the stations aren't commercially viable. Google, VeriSign, IBM and Microsoft all joined the OpenID Foundation this week, putting some serious cash behind the project. With Yahoo on board and Google implementing the standard on Blogger, OpenID is well on its way to becoming the web's de facto sign-on identity. And 20 UK startups are to be whisked to Silicon Valley as part of Web Mission, a joint government and tech industry initiative to support and encourage promising entrepreneurs. The chosen ones will spend a week in San Francisco during the Web 2 Expo, meeting with US startups and tech giants, including Microsoft.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Jemima. I wanted to pick up briefly on the front page thing from The Guardian the other day, which you mentioned in the news, which was the games industry clampdown. I found that particularly interesting, primarily because I wasn't really sure why it was front page news.
I thought we kind of knew that the rating system was on the way, but you know, it's still very worthy of being promoted.
Oh, absolutely.
And come on, remember the children. It's about the children. We must protect the children. Sorry.
Why hasn't there been a rating system on games?
Well, there already
Alex?
Is. There already is a rating system. In fact, there are two. I think what they're really focusing on here is they want to make the BBFC rating system across the board. So basically from, you know, your children's games all the way up to your adult games. Only mature games at the moment have to submit for. The other system is the PEGI system, which is a pan-European system. which all games have to go through as well, including those that are, you know, that are for the children's market. But that's a voluntary system, so there are no legalities associated with it. But what I found particularly interesting about this was how the onus is not just on the sort of government regulation of games, but on the fact that they want parents to, you know, make sure that their kids don't have games consoles in their bedrooms.
Some parents just don't care, though, surely.
Can you imagine?
How are they going to enforce this? I mean, how are they going to get the parents to actually play police for their kids? I mean,
you can just start hearing the nanny state cries. You can, you know, what a kid's playing a Nintendo DS or a PSP in their bedrooms. And do you actually want to hear the sounds of death, murder, and destruction while you're chopping vegetables for dinner? I personally, unless I'm actually playing it, I don't. But anyway, so that's that bit of news. And I found that particularly interesting that it was on the front page. The second thing that I thought was really interesting is something that I keep hearing about again and again, and this is OpenID. Kevin, can you tell us a little bit more about this? Because I know some, but I'm certainly not an expert.
So do you remember Microsoft Passport?
Yeah.
So when you signed in Hotmail, you had this option to use Passport. Microsoft originally wanted that to be kind of a universal sign-on for a bunch of websites around the web. Of course, it didn't really take off. OpenID is an open alternative to that. So it's basically one password, one username and password, and you can then sign on to, you know, a myriad of sites all around the web. But instead of being a specific company, it's meant to be an open standard. That's what it is.
So instead of just signing into Microsoft's products, it's, you know, signing into
the cloud.
The cloud, yes, indeed.
Kind of.
Well, signing into your blogging platform, into your photo sharing platform, your social network, you know, a myriad of things. And so it's meant to have also, in not just a single sign-on type of thing, but it's also meant to help bring elements of your identity along so that, you know, right now I may have three or four different usernames on three or four different sites. But this would be one username that people would get to know you and you'd have some reputation with it. So there's a number of different elements.
And this, of course, is interesting because I've heard some people talk about this with reference to games, you know, taking your World of Warcraft experience into Second Life, into
portable karma.
Very interesting. And I'm sure we'll talk a lot more about this in the future. You can find this and keep up with the latest headlines throughout the week at guardian.co.uk/technology. Another incredible shrinking device is hitting the market, as per Charles's predictions of 2008 back at the Christmas show. The EPC, also known as the RM Notebook in the UK, is a teeny, lightweight, and importantly, extremely cheap new laptop. Charles has been testing out the new brainchild of the Asus Corporation, and he sent this report.
Who made that noise? Use the spacebar to move, and you return the key to choose. Hooray!
That's the sound of the RM MiniBook, which is an interesting new development in the whole world of small portable computers. It's got four things going for it that no other laptop has at the moment. It's much cheaper. The price starts at around £170. It's much smaller. It looks like the love child of one of Apple's iBooks and a Nintendo DS handheld console. It's very light. It weighs about a kilogram. And it doesn't run Windows. The MiniBook, which in other countries is known as the Asus PC, Asus is the company that makes it, has come about because the price of making these machines has fallen so far that Asus can simply afford to make it and find people who'll sell it in other countries for these low prices. RM is aiming it at the education market. But we thought we'd try it out in a home environment with my kids, who range in age from 3 to 10.
My favourite programmes are probably doing a slideshow. You can kind of draw pictures and you can make kind of these mini presentations for anything. I prefer using this smaller computer than the big computer because one thing is that it's easier to carry around.
Thanks! We all had a turn and you helped us share out the food.
They're really happy with it. So watching them, what I've realised is that there's a number of things about this machine they really like, particularly the size of the keys. Adult laptops have much larger keyboards, and I think children find it a strain. This is much smaller because the screen is only 7 inches across. The machine is scaled to fit, but that actually fits a child's hand much better. They find it much easier to type with. The weight of the machine is another big advantage for them. They can just carry it around from room to room and not worry about breaking their backs. And it's very sensibly laid out. The software is all really easy for them to find. One of the nice things about it is it's completely silent. There's no hard drive, which doesn't mean it doesn't have any storage. It uses what's called flash storage, which is the same as Apple has on a lot of the range of its iPods. And as time goes on, the amount of memory you'll get will grow and grow.
I think the laptop isn't very good. They could make the laptop better off making a bigger screen and a bigger keyboard.
There are a couple of things I find annoying about the computer. One is that the Wi-Fi is quite hard to connect sometimes.
What I've also observed from watching them and trying it out myself is that it's not perfect. The software isn't always as good as you'd like it to be. It's not always child-focused. They get dialogue boxes that come up and say, do you want to save it in this location? They have no idea what location means. Another thing I've noticed is that if you turn the machine off or if you suspend it for a while and then restart it, it doesn't always pick up the Wi-Fi network that it was connected to, the wireless networks that so many of us use now. That can be annoying, and I think many children would find it a bit confusing, certainly at first. But it's not a deal breaker because you can work your way around it. And my 10-year-old daughter was able to figure that out pretty fast. I think the RM MiniBook is a really promising product. It deserves to do well in the education area where it's much cheaper than buying a full-size computer. I think for primary school children, it would be a shoo-in, really. But here's the real test, eh? Let's see whether the children want to hang on to it or whether they're glad to see the back of it. OK, kids, shall I take the laptop away then?
No!
Thank you very much, Charles. We'll see what happens in that domestic argument. So who do you think is going to buy this product? Because it sounds very much like it's directed towards children. But Kevin, you were telling me before that you know somebody who's used this professionally. So
yeah, it was just last week somebody was using a presentation and I've got a friend who wants to take it as a really ultra-portable sound editing system. He's a radio producer. I mean, for me, I think it's great for children because the keyboard's a child size. I can't use it. My fat fingers just run all over it.
It's great for kids. It's great for parents who want to introduce their children to technology early on. But it's also quite good for people who covet technology and who just want something that's light and portable. It's £200, isn't it?
Well, is it pretty hard wearing as well? Because I'm very tough on my hardware.
I mean, there's a lot of benefits to it. I think, you know, whether it's going to be that or something like the IBM now Lenovo X series, which is kind of in the same ballpark. But also, you know, it's not 200 quid, it's 1500 quid or 1100 quid, so different price.
So the EPC varies in price, but it's generally less than £200. And if you want to know more, there's a report by Polly Curtis on the GU already about the machine's usefulness in schools. You can see that at guardian.co.uk/technology. You've heard enough from us. Let's hear what you have to say. Over on the games blog, the community has been going ape over the latest leakage from the Byron Report, which we mentioned earlier on in the program. Saturday's front page piece on government regulation and tighter parental controls has sent them into a cloud of fury, like this from Wide Awake Wesley. Ratings are a pointless waste of time. Any child can get their hands on any game they want via parents, friends, the internet, etc. And the majority of parents will let them play in their own rooms because it's far easier to let a games console play with your children than have it do it yourself, which I think, you know, tells a state of parenting today. But others have a different point of view, like this one from Casino Soul. The only people who seem particularly keen on this crackdown are late middle-aged middle-class types who no longer have any direct involvement with the issue, but want something simple to blame for social disintegration, and the ambitious junior ministers that are keen to court them. Goodness me, it's hot on the games blog. This issue will continue to heat up over the next few weeks. Kevin, what do you have from the tech blog?
Well, Jack Schofield, in his one-man campaign against Google, had a post about Google adopting Microsoft's own strong-arm tactics to oppose Microsoft's tie-up with Yahoo. And it solicited this response from Joe H. Google are like the pigs on Animal Farm, who, on realizing that they enjoyed their power, amended the first principle of all animals are equal to include, but some are more equal than others. Surely it's just a matter of time before don't be evil is changed to include, unless it makes us money.
Oh, nice Orwell reference. Exactly. We like that.
All right, Jemima.
Well, obviously it's Love Week this week. So we did an elevator pitch for Fuel My Blog, which is a blogging community. And sometimes when you do an elevator pitch, there's a kind of flurry of, yes, I like this site. You're right, that's a bit suspicious. But these guys just piled in, and it was actually quite heartwarming to see them kind of saying, no, it's really good, it really is good. And they were really very excited about it. So an example of those is The Real Fracas, who said, it might not be the next big thing, but to those of us who've been there from almost the beginning, it's certainly a big thing in its own right. Kevin and Sylvie, who run the site, certainly deserve a cheering section. It is what other places are not, a real community. And there were loads of other posts with the same sentiment, but I thought that was rather nice.
It's very heartwarming, isn't it? Kevin, you looked like your heart was being warmed.
Yeah, I mean, the funny thing is sometimes we pay attention to these sort of, battle royales online, and we forget there's some nice cozy little corners of the internet that we like to go.
Thank you very much for that, Jemima. Heartwarming corners of the internet. Aww. And speaking of heartwarming corners, Kevin, you have to go off to get your hair cut for your all blogger wedding.
Yes, all blogger wedding.
Hugh Grant style. He's heading off right now. You can follow his wedding on Twitter.
Believe me,
I'm not joking.
Thank you very much, Kevin, for coming in. See you after the honeymoon.
Bye. Off to Barbados. Bye.
Anyway, you can have your say on these and many other issues on the blog at blogs.byguardian.co.uk.
That actually was the door closing. Yeah, exactly. It wasn't a sound effect.
No sound effect there. /games/technology/digital-content. Now it's the nation's favourite startup feature, the Tech Weekly Elevator Pitch. Jemima welcomes Nestoria into the lift this week.
Welcome to Elevator Pitch.
Ground floor. Please mind the doors.
Which floor would you like?
Home and garden, please.
Going up.
So who are you and what's your company?
My name's Ed Freifogel and I'm one of the founders of a site called Nestoria.
Okay then. Explain your business to my mum in two sentences.
Very simple. We do one thing and one thing only. We help you find a house or a flat to buy or rent. We try to keep it very, very simple, very clean, very easy to use, and the results are very relevant and displayed in a fast, friendly manner on a map. So far, people seem to like it.
First floor.
So how are you funded then?
Well, we got very lucky when we started that we were able to find some very generous and very patient angel investors.
So how do you make money?
Our business model is the same as almost all other search engines, be it Google or Yahoo or MSN, in that basically we show users relevant links and then they click on them. And some of those links are sponsored and people, we get paid by the various people that we provide the leads to.
How many full-time staff do you employ?
The company was founded by myself and one other founder, and now we have about 7 other employees based here in London. And then we recently launched Nestoria for Spain as well, so we have 1 employee in Madrid.
Second floor.
So where do you want to be in 5 years' time?
Ideally, we'll have expanded to some other markets, and of course, we'll have grown in terms of usership and revenues and things like that. But we really are hoping to keep it as a small company.
And if you had £10 million to invest in any company other than your own, what would you invest in?
I think almost certainly that would be in Facebook, although I don't think they would take my money because I think so many people are trying to give them money.
Third floor.
How many users do you have now, and what's your target within 12 months?
So as I said, we're in 2 countries, Spain and the UK, and between those 2 countries, probably this month, January, we'll do 500,000 unique users, according to Comscore. There is some seasonality. January is always a very strong month. So we're pleased with 500,000, but we still have a long way to go.
So, are you the next big thing?
If you're searching for a home to buy or rent, we're definitely the next big thing.
Fourth floor. Doors opening.
Hey, this is not Home and Garden.
That was Ed from Nestoria. So, Jemima, how is this marketplace laid out online?
Well, it's a very, very competitive area, obviously, and property is one area that traditional media sites have tried to kind of push really, really hard alongside motoring and jobs as kind of a solid, reliable, lucrative area online. These guys have got arguably a more kind of tech-savvy Web 2 approach. Ed Freifogel is actually ex-Yahoo.
How viable is their model in this marketplace?
Well, it's very interesting. There are 3 types of businesses in the property area. There are the giants like Rightmove, who work with all the estate agents to do a very formal and quite kind of old-fashioned sort of business model, really. Then there are other sites that scrape the internet to kind of informally get this data. And then there's a slight question about, you know, obviously some sites thinking that they're not that legitimate. Nestoria are doing something in the middle, which is using RSS feeds of data, which seems like a very obvious approach. It's very Web 2.
It really does seem like a blindingly obvious approach.
Well, exactly, yes. Yeah. But they're also doing white label services for the Independence website and for Channel 4. So it's clearly an approach that traditional web publishers can understand and get their heads around and adapt the technology for their own sites really easily.
But at the same time, they're kind of competing with some of the other Web 2 or even the sort of community-based things. Things like Craigslist. Kevin and I were speaking about that before. Craigslist in the US, they're selling a lot of property now, or rather they're the white space for people to sell property. Places like Gumtree, that kind of thing.
That's true, but those are consumer-facing services. So those are for individuals to post services, and they try and discourage wholesale advertising of services, whereas Nestoria is really trying to do things wholesale, so building up big scale partners that can really add, you know, thousands and thousands of properties at a time.
We all have seen the headlines, and property owners amongst us have, you know, bitten our nails to the quick. Is this really the best time for them to be getting into the property market?
Well, that's a very interesting question. Very competitive space, loads going on. If there's hardly any houses being sold, then obviously that's, you know, their bread and butter. So I have no idea what's going to happen with that, but I do know they have a very strong, very confident and very popular kind of Web 2 approach that I think will put them in fairly good stead.
Excellent. Thank you very much. And if you've got a new startup, please do email it to jemima.kish@guardian.co.uk. There's more elevator pitch madness at blogs.guardian.co.uk/digital content.
Hello, I'm Matt Wells, and on the latest Media Talk podcast, Overdosing on Demand, we discuss Sky Plus, the iPlayer and Freeview, and the future of streamed and downloadable TV. Also in the podcast, we wrap up a week of woe at Whopping, plus Jane Garvey attacks Radio 4 for being too middle class, and 5 has an art attack, but will it prove fatal for the network's future? It's all on the new Media Talk at guardian.co.uk/podcasts.
That's it now from Tech Weekly, so goodbye from us, and thanks very much to Kevin, Jemima, the absent Charles, the absent Bobby, to our guests and our intrepid producer, Scott. I'm Alex Kratowski, and thank you very much for listening. If you have anything to say, please do feel free to get in touch at tech@guardian.co.uk, tech, T-E-C-H, @guardian.co.uk, and tell your friends. You can get this podcast on your local subscription service. Until next week.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.